Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Ted Amud Aleph. The Gemara has continued to discuss a number of brayot that were brought down with regards to bells. The issue that we were discussing was, in the brayot it said, nitnu in vilehen, if their clappers were taken out, adayin tumatan alehen. Their bells still have a din of tuma. And the Gemara wants to know, the maichazu. Once you take the clapper out of the bell, it's rendered useless, and therefore, why should have a din of tuma? In order to have tuma, you have to have a functional kli. And here you don't have that anymore, because you've ruined the bell by taking the clapper out. So Abaye answered, because since a layperson could return it to its former state, we view it as if it was never really separated, never really taken apart, because it's so easy to put the clapper back in place. Rava challenged Abaye's position from both a Mishnah and a Braita in Kelim, from which he proves that, according to Rashi, once you have taken apart the clapper and the bell, they no longer are considered to be a whole kli, because you've ruined or taken away a part of the kli, and that shows you that even if you can put it back together, it's still considered rendered ois kli, or no longer a kli, once the clapper has been removed from the bell. Whereas the Baal Tosafot just suggests that until you replace the clapper into the bell, we don't assume that they are considered to be an entity that the tuma is unified between them, and therefore only the clapper can become tuma, not the hollow bell, unless they are put back together. And so you see that the ability to put it back together is not sufficient. For that reason, Rava rejects Abaye and makes the following suggestion, which is, Hol v'ra oila kisho agabi cheres. You have the ability to use the bell, even without a clapper, by using something externally to hit on the bell and make the noise that it did beforehand. So even without a clapper, the bell can still function in a similar fashion that it did originally, and that's why it still is mekabel tuma. Rashi summarized the Gemaras that we had seen until now in all the brayot by telling us that there are three types of bells. There's a bell for a behema, there's a bell for a gadol, person who is older, and there is a bell for a katan. As far as the bell of a behema, irrespective of whether it never had a clapper in it, or whether it lost its clapper, it is always tahor, because there's no such thing as a tachshit for a behema, and since it's not a kli maaseh, there's nothing functional about it at this point in time, and obviously the animal itself is not going about ringing or banging on that bell to make noise, so therefore it's always tahor. For a gadol, it's the opposite way around, it's always tamei, the bell. That's whether the bell had a clapper originally and lost it, or whether it never had a clapper at all, and that's because people who are older wear these things in a decorative fashion, they wear them as jewelry, they wear them as accessories to their clothing, and therefore they're mekabel tuma, whether they have a inbal, whether they have a clapper in them, whether they don't have a clapper in them, whether they did have a clapper and they lost it, no matter what it is, tamei. The distinction that the Gemara made here with regards to whether the clapper's in or not, as Rashi notes over here, only refers to the bell of a katan. And that is when the katan has a clapper inside of it, then that is considered to be tamei, because then it's functional and it's a tachshit. So too, if the bell originally had a clapper in it and then lost the clapper, it still would have a din of tuma, because it could still function by having the child play with it, bang it, or make the noise. The only time it'll be tahor is when the bell was originally made without a clapper in it. And that's the distinction there between the katan, between when it is tahor, when it is tamei, and the difference between whether, even if when its clapper is taken out, it still is tamei. So that's how Rashi summarizes everything we've seen until now. And the Gemara says, Itmarnami, we have the following machloket amoraim, which is Amar Rav Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina, hoil v'roi la kisho agave cheres. The reason the bell retains its status as a kli, even after the clapper is taken out, is for the same reason that Rova suggested before, which is that you can use something externally, you can use some piece of pottery or hard object to bang the bell on the outside, and still have its original function. Rav Yochanan Amar, hoil v'roi la gameo bo maim l'tinok. Because you have the ability to use it as a sippy cup or a small cup for a young child to drink from. So it has some usage even after the clapper is taken out of it. Now, according to this, we have three answers as to why the bell retains its tuma. There's a Baye who says, because you can put it back together. There is Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, and Rabbi Yochanan, one who says that it's because externally you can bang on it. And Rabbi Yochanan who says that because you can give it to a tinok to drink. Between them, the big nafkamino is that according to Abaye, both pieces of the bell will be mekabel tuma. That is because both the clapper and the bell itself are still considered to be a single unit because a layperson can put it back together. For that reason, each independent part will retain its status as a kli and never be mekabel tuma. According to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, and Rabbi Yochanan, the only part that retains its status as a kli is the bell itself. The clapper is not functional and is not longer part of the story here anymore. The only thing that retains Tuma is the bell itself. So that's a big nafkamina between Abaye and Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yossi Baruch Hanina. The Balei HaTosafot, on the position of Rabbi Yochanan, question, how is it possible that the usage of the bell to give a drink to a little baby could make it into something that is Tameh? He says, don't you need to be miyached? You have to designate something for a particular purpose before it becomes the utility of such a kli. And if you did such, of course it would be mekabel tuma, because now you've made it or changed it into a different function. So if you originally thought about giving it to a tinok, then even Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina would agree that it is tameh because it had that function from the outset. And if it did not have that function from the outset, then how is it that the conversion of it into this drinking cup suddenly makes it into something that can be mekabel tuma, or something that retains its tuma, if you were never miyached, if you never designated it for that particular purpose? So the Balei HaTosafot, in order to resolve that problem, says that Rabbi Yochanan really still relies on Abaye. And that is that Abaye said that it was easy to put the bell back together. Since it was simple for a layperson to reconstruct the bell, what Tosafot says is, the alternative usage of giving a drink to a tinok is a bridge or a stopgap solution to keeping it as a kli. Since in the interim stage, while the clapper is not there, you can use it to give a drink to a tinok. Plus, since you could put the clapper back in very easily, that is why it retains its shem tuma, even without being miyached, even without designating the item for that particular purpose. And that's what the Balei HaTosafot say over here. Since hoel demikara v'kli gamur, over here, since in the beginning it was a full-fledged kli, a bell, and since today, if you wanted to, after the clapper fell out, any layperson could put it back together, it landed the meimar. We have to say that yadei davar mu'at, shadayin ro'ui ligmoa bo ma'im, since there is a small functional utility to this item, even without the clapper, koshiv kli, it retains or sustains its status as a kli, afilu below yichud, even if you did not designate it for that particular purpose. So that's how the Balei HaTosafot explain it, and they say that Rabbi Yochanan is really resting on the shoulders of Abaye. Other Rishonim, like the Ritva and the Rashba, disagree and say that it has nothing to do with Abaye, but even if it only could be repaired or replaced by a craftsperson, it still would have this status of Tumah. And that the tziruf between the ability to restore the bell to its former state, even if it can't be done by a layperson, even if it only can be done by a craftsman, plus the fact that it can be used now for a tinok, those two items combined make it that it retains its shame kli. So that's in terms of the din of kli, or why, according to Rabbi Yochanan, even if you don't designate it for that purpose, it still has consideration as a kli, according to Balei HaTosafot, because of a baye that a layperson can put it back together, or according to Rashba the Ritva, because a craftsman could put it back together. And that's enough, together with the fact that you could use it to feed or give to drink a tinok, those would cause it to retain its shame kli. Now the Gemara asks the very obvious question here, which is, Rabbi Yochanan lo baye me'in malacha rishona? Doesn't Rabbi Yochanan require that when a kli is in function or utilized for a particular purpose, in order for it to retain its tuma or sustain its shame kli, it would have to continue to function like the original purpose of the kli? If you repurpose the kli, then it now becomes a new kli. But if you use it for some semblance of the original purpose, then you can claim that it is still the same kli as it was before, and therefore the tuma does not depart, or the shame kli does not depart from this item. Over here, you're moving from utilization for sound, ringing a bell, to giving a tinok to drink. So the utility that you have from it now has nothing to do with the original purpose that you put the bell together, and therefore, how could it be that that's sufficient grounds for us to say that it retains its shem kli, and it still would be tameh, or be mekabel tuma, because it has its original shem kli with it? Vatanya, don't we have a braita that speaks about tumat midras? Tumat midras is the tuma from individuals who have tuma that's yotzei migufan, like a zav, a zava, a nida, mitzora. All of those individuals have tumat mishkav, moshav. If they sit on something, if they lay on something, which is broadly known as tumat midras, those items become tameh, even if they don't come into direct contact with the item, simply that they sat on a number of items that were below them, everything below them becomes tameh. Similarly, when they lay on something, everything below them becomes tameh, as if they touched that item. So it says in the bright, the b'chol kli, asher yeshev alav, any kli upon which they sit. Yochol, you would think that anything they sat on would have this status. Kafas sa'ah. You take a dry measure of a sa'ah. V'yashavala. You flipped it over and then you sat on it like a stool, like a chair. Kafat tarkav. Or you took a tarkav. Tarkav is half a sa'ah. Sa'ah is six kav. A tarkav is three kav, and it's constructed of a contraction of tray and kav. Two and one more kav makes it three kav. Half the size of a sa'ah, but also another dry measure. You flipped it over, and then you sat on it. You would think all these things would be tamei tumat midras. The zav, or whatever the individual is who is tamei, that would cause tumat midras, sat on the item. So why shouldn't the item become tamei? Talmud lomar, asher yeshev alav. The Torah says, v'chol kli asher yeshev alav, that asher yeshev alav means mi shemiuchad l'yishiva, only something that's designated for sitting on. Yatzazeh, excluded from is this item, shomrim lo amod v'naseh melachteinu, where we tell the person to get off of it so we can use it for its primary purpose. The primary purpose of a sa'ah, the primary purpose of a tarkab, is for measuring. It's for dry measures. Just because somebody flipped it over and sat on it doesn't make it into a chair. Doesn't make it into something that's mekabel tumat midras. Because if the person does do that and sit on it, we say to him, excuse me, can you please get up? We need to use it as a measuring cup or to use it as a measuring tool. And because of that, it is not mekabel tumat midras. Rashi over here makes a number of points. The first of which is, what is the limud from the pasuk? He says that there's some people that suggest it comes from the duplication of the word yeshiva in the pasuk. Rashi rejects that because we use that limud for something else. Rather, he says that it has to do with the usage of the word yeshiv. It does not say in the pasuk chol kli asher yashav alav, any kli that he sat on in the past, but rather asher yeshev alav, any kli that he sits on, which is written in the present tense, almost like a present perfect, which is that it continues or continuously is in function to be sat on. And that's how Rashi says we learn out the fact that it has to be something that is designated for sitting on and continuously used in that manner because it uses the present tense of the form, yeshev. And for that we learn that only something that's designated for that purpose and is used and utilized in that way will be mekabel tumat midras. It has another purpose, and it's just been appropriated or repurposed to be used as a seat now, it will not be mekabel tumat midras. So now Rashi then says that there are two dinim that come out of this in terms of tumat midras. The first of which is that up front, in order for something to be mekabel tumat midras, it has to have this quality about it, which is that the item is a functional seat, some that you normally sit on, or some that you normally lay on. So in order to be mekabel tuma up front, it must have that status. The second thing Rashi points out is that if something originally had the status of something that you sat on or you laid on, if it was a piece of cloth, it was something bigger. And then for whatever reason, that was changed. It got cut in half. It became too small to serve in that function. It will also lose its tumat midras. Now, tumat midras is a higher level of tuma by which there can be conveyance of tuma from, for instance, the zav to the item, even if he doesn't come into contact with it. And it also renders the item at the level of tuma of an abba tuma. On the other hand, if it's not tumat midras, then it would only be tumat maga. It would drop down a level of tuma to possibly a rishon l'tuma, or maybe even lower. Although for a kli, rishon l'tuma is the last level, depending on what the item is that we're speaking about. So because of that, Rashi says you have two dinim. One din is that up front it has to be ro'oy l'midras in order to be mekabel tumah. Number two is if it was ro'oy l'midras and then that was taken away or destroyed somehow, then that also loses its tumat midras and drops down to a level of tumat maga. That's a suggestion of the Gemara. Just like we do that by midrasot, so too we would do the same thing by tumat amei. And that turns out to be a machloket amuraim. Where Rabbi Lazar Omer b'midrasot omrim amod v'naseh melachteinu, we say that by tumat midras, v'en omrim b'tamei meit amod v'naseh melachteinu, doesn't have application by tumat amet. The other hand, Rabbi Yochanan amar, af omer b'tamei meit amod v'naseh melachteinu. Rabbi Yochanan says that even by tumat amet, we do say, or we do apply, amod v'naseh melachteinu. So according to Rashi, what that means is, Rashi claims that the question of the Gemara then is based on that second part of the statement, which is that just like by the Zav, we say Amod v'naseh melachteinu, why don't we say the same thing with regards to Tumat Hamet? By Tumat Hamet, why don't we say that something that is designated for a particular purpose, and then if it is repurposed, it will no longer be Mekabel Tumah. Rashi says up front, you can't claim that it won't be Mekabel Tumah, Because you're going to say then that only things that are designated for the dead individual are mekabel tumah. There's no such restriction in the Torah, no such limitation in the Torah. Torah says anything that's a kli masa, and it's a functional kli with utility to it, can be mekabel tumah tamei. So that can't be a limitation in the upfront tumah. It is only a limitation that the Gemara is suggesting now in the back end, which is that once something becomes tamei, if it was functional in a certain way, if you take away that function, then we say, let's go back to its original function. And if you can't go back to the original function, it should no longer be tamei tumat mei, just like something that was originally designated for midras that lost that ability to do that. For instance, it was a large piece of cloth, and then it was torn down into pieces that are too small for midras. There's no longer any tumat midras, even though it was a tamei already. So too over here, with regards to our bell. If the bell was already tamei up front, and now you have it lost its clapper, so it's no longer functional like its original purpose, and you say, okay, we can give it to the little kid to drink from, that's fine, but why don't we just say, amod benasem lachtenu, go back to its original purpose. You go back to original purpose, that which to give a drink to the child with it does not change the status of the fact that it's lost its former status, lost its former utility, and therefore it should no longer be considered a kli, and the tumata mate should not have application to this. Whereas Tosafot feels that the question comes from the original statement of the Braita, because he says, according to Rashi, the core part of the question is missing here, because the Braita they quoted is speaking about tumat midras from the outset, not ridding oneself or changing the status of tumat midras to some other tumat. And so there, ikar chaser min ha-sefer. Therefore, the Braita Tosafot would say the question is from the fact that up front, tumat midras is not relevant when it comes to something that has a different function and you come and sit on it. So too, what they're suggesting now is maybe when you repurpose a kli, when it was originally a bell, and now you're trying to give it or use it as a cup for a drink, why don't we say the same thing? Let's go back to its original purpose. That's what it was designated for. Since that's its designation, therefore, since it doesn't work like that anymore because the clapper's missing, it'll be tahor. And so the Gemara's suggestion, according to that, is that Rabbi Yochanan would say, just like by tumat midras, there is no tumat midras from the outset. When it's an object where we say, let it function in its primary purpose, so too over here. Maybe there should be no tumat mate with regards to the bell because it no longer functions like its original function. The problem, obviously, is that Rabbi Yochanan makes it clear here that you need to have something have this similar function to its original utility in order to maintain its tumah or to be mekabel tumah. And that's not the case over here because he's making a suggestion that you're switching from a bell to a cup for a young child. So that would be a stira in the position of Rabbi Yochanan. And the Gemara answer is epoch kamaita. Flip the original positions. The original positions means the machlok between Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina, and Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan will be the one who agrees with Rava and says that because you can clap it with a external item, that the bell retains its original status and is tamei or can be mekabel tumah. And Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina will be the one that says, since it maintains a semblance of utility, even though it's not like the original utility, that's enough to keep the shame clean on it. Mar says, my chazit, kam davacht kamaita ipoch batraita. Why did you flip Rabbi Yochanan's position when he argued on Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina? Why didn't you flip Rabbi Yochanan's position when he argues on Rabbi Elazar? How do you know which one is the right position for Rabbi Yochanan? And how do you know which one is the incorrect one to flip it with the other party that argues with him? Mar says, hashmeinan le the Rabbi Yochanan debay mei melacha rishona. Because we have another source that tells us Rabbi Yochanan believes for tumah, an object must maintain or retain some semblance of its original utility in order for it to maintain a shame kli or to still be tamei. An example is from the Mishnah in Kelim, the Tnan, sandal shel behema shel matechet. If you have a shoe, like a horseshoe, a shoe for an animal that's made out of metal, now there is a girsa in the Mishnah, but it says sandal shel behema tmeya, of a non-kosher animal. It's interesting because kosher animals have split hooves. Therefore, the shoe for an animal that is a kosher animal would be split in the middle and then wouldn't have the functions we're going to see later. Only an animal that doesn't have a split hoof might possibly have, not like today where we have horseshoes that are the shape of a horseshoe, but it seems like it was a whole plate of metal that went on the bottom, and that would be more along the lines of what's being suggested here, and so therefore, it might be true that it's only by behemah tmeah, not by behemah torah, that we're speaking about these types of shoes. So that is tameh. Gemara says, lamai chazi. If it's no longer a shoe of an animal, then what is it useful for? Meaning, as a shoe of an animal, then it's simply a kli for the behema, and a clay behema would not be mekabel tuma. And we also said ain takshit behema. There's no such thing as jewelry or decorative items for a behema. So that's certainly not what's making it tameh here. So amarav ra'oi lishtop bo mayim b'milchama. When you're in battle and you need to grab some water, you can use it to scoop up water and to drink from it. It must have had some sort of receptacle in the middle. Again, speaking of ankosh animal, as a plate of metal that went on the foot, there might have been some area where you could use it for drinking from. You could use it to anoint oil with it during the battle. He can borrow it when he's running away in the battle and he needs to move fast. He can use it to run on top of the thorns and the thistles and not hurt his feet, so he can put it on as a shoe for himself as well. So you see here that the reason that it's tamei is because it has function for the human being. Now, the examples given by Rav and Rabbi Chanina are functions that have nothing to do with the original utility of the item. The utility of the item is a shoe, and you're now repurposing it either for drinking or for anointing oneself, and that's considered to be okay to make it into kli tuma. Rabbi Yochanan does not accept that and says it has to be repurposed into a shoe for an individual. Once it's been repurposed for an individual, then it becomes kabel tuma. Tosafot over here says, wait a minute, if you repurpose it as a shoe can be mekabel tumat midras. So why are we only speaking about tumat amet over here? This now becomes something where it has tumat midras because you rest your feet on it, and therefore we should be speaking about much higher levels of tumat, tumat midras, and not just tumat amet. So although Tosafot doesn't answer the question, there are achronim that make the suggestion that there is a distinction by midras, as we saw before, that something has to be designated fully for that purpose in order to be considered in the world of tumat midras. And just because one individual uses it in that manner, especially here where it's an unusual or emergency situation where he uses it like that, that's not sufficient grounds to make it into tumat midras and assume that it takes on this shoe form for human beings, because it's not something where it's usually used in that manner. Tosafot also asks, if it's sufficient here to make something tamei because it was a shoe for an animal and now you drink from it during the battle and that's enough to make it into a kli that can be kabel tuma, then why don't we say the same thing by a bell that never had an clapper in it? If it never had a clapper in it, then you could use it for drinking and that should be sufficient grounds to make it into something that is mekabel tuma. So Tosafot answers that v'yesh lamar, that when it comes to the animal's shoe, there, the original intent is for the animal's shoe, but in the back of your mind, you think about the possibility that it could be used in battle in an emergency situation. So that is considered up front. By a bell, nobody considers up front that that's going to be a cup, or that's going to be used to feed a tinok, and therefore it's something that is totally outside the realm of the function or utility of the bell, and that's why it's not sufficient grounds to make it tamei, even if it was made without a clapper up front. Other achronim suggest that the difference is that by the bell without a clapper, that's not a kli that reached gemar melocha, never reached its final stage where it was a finished kli, and therefore you can't say, though, it has another purpose and then makes it into a kli. It never reached the status of a kli or its original utility. Here, by the shoe of the behema, it reached its full utility, which was that it was going to be used for shuva behema. Now, if it has other purposes to it as well, that will be sufficient grounds to allow it to continue to be a kli or to give it tuma, because it was a full-fledged kli. It's not just a kli that didn't reach its final stage. So now the Gemara says, "My ben Rav, the Rabbi Chanina. What's the nafkamina between Rav and Rabbi Chanina? Ikubanayu demois. The difference between them is if the shoe is dirty or disgusting." According to Rabbi Chanina, nobody's going to drink water from this item in a battle because the shoe of a behema is disgusting and dirty. Whereas Rav believes that people in an emergency situation would use it for that. He also believes that Rabbi Chanina is wrong because nobody is anointing themselves with oil during a battle. That's not the type of activity that you engage in, and therefore that's not sufficient grounds to make it into something that is tamei. Rashi goes on to say that that distinction also exists between Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, which is that Rav believes that when it is ma'us, you still might use it for drinking water, as Rabbi Yochanan would not think that you can use it for water, but he also agrees with Rav that you don't anoint yourself during the battle, and therefore Rabbi Yochanan has the opinion that it has to be that you would use it as an escape shoe, and that's why it's mekabel tumah. But if you explain the Rashi, then according to the Chazon Ish, that takes away the proof from the Mishnah that Rabbi Yochanan really believes that you need Me'ein Melachto, because Rabbi Yochanan could be just saying this because it was Ma'us, he believes that Rav's wrong, and he thinks because of not anointing oneself during the battle, that's also not a good answer. And he gives his answer, but had it not been Ma'us, had it not been disgusting, he would agree with Rav that drinking from it would have been sufficient. And then you have no proof that Rabbi Yochanan believes Me'ein Melachto. So Ein Al Kanami, that's what the Marsha says, the Gemara just did now, which was that the Gemara just rejected this view that Rabbi Yochanan thinks that it's Me'ein Melachto. It's very hard to say, because then the next line of the Gemara doesn't make sense, because we'll see in a second that Rabbi Yochanan clearly requires something to be Me'ein Melachto HaRishona. And so therefore the Chazon Ish says that the Marsha's answer is not understandable, that he thinks that the Gemara now rejected this view that Rabbi Yochanan needs Me'ein Melachto HaRishona. So he suggests against Rashi over here that everybody agrees to Rabbi Yochanan's position, and Rav would agree with Rabbi Yochanan, unlike what Rashi suggests, is that there is a difference of opinion. And then Rav and Rabbi Chanina are just simply coming to say that even if Rabbi Yochanan's reason is not true, there are other reasons that could make it Tameh. And when would Rabbi Yochanan's position not be true? That's the next nafkamino in the Gemara. But the difference between Ben Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Chanina, Ike Benayu, the menachamim between them, is the yakir, if it's heavy. If the animal's shoe is very heavy, then it's not a great vehicle for using it as an escape, because it's going to slow you down and you're not going to be able to move with it. So in that case, Rabbi Yochanan would say that it's not Tameh. Rabbi Chanina would say that you could still use a heavy item like that for anointing oneself. And that would be the way that the Chazon Ish learns here, is that everybody agrees, like Rabbi Yochanan, that if it is used as a shoe, then that is good. That it makes it so it's Tameh. Their disagreement is when it's too heavy to use as a shoe, does it still have another purpose that would then continue to make it Tameh? And Rav and Rabbi Chanina state their opinions. And in that way, you avoid the problem of Rabbi Yochanan sounding like he doesn't require Me'ein Melachto, because that is fundamental to his position over here. And he's not just disagreeing because it's Ma'us in this case, or because you don't believe that you put oil on in the middle of a milchama. That's why he came up with that answer. No, it's fundamental that he believes that it has to be Me'ein Melachto. And that's why the Gemara was forced to say that Rabbi Yochanan's position that we started out with today needs to be flipped to Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina, to have Rabbi Yochanan be consistent that only when it's Me'ein Melachto HaRishona does something retain its tumah. Now the Gemara continues, V'lo bi'ir shel zahav. Rashi on the Mishnah spoke about an ir shel hazahav being something like a brooch of some sort. The Rabbeinu Tam over here disagrees and says that it's not what Rashi described as a nushka, but it's more like a crown-like golden Yushalayim that had the walls and the towers of Yushalayim on it. And Rabbeinu Tam proves that from the Gemara in Sotah that discusses it, even though that Gemara says that they put a takana in place, that one is no longer allowed to wear a Yushalayim Shel Zahav after Churban HaBayit. The Rabbeinu Tam solved that problem by saying that's only true by a Chatan and Kala. By a bride, is that true? Because she's too much Simcha, it's too high a point of celebration in the face of Churban HaBayit. But regular people that are wearing this as a piece of jewelry, that's not considered to be too big a simcha, or too much decoration in the face of Churban HaBayit. So Rashi and the Tosafot over here argue exactly what this ir shel zahav is. And the Gemara asks, my ir shel zahav. What is this ir shel zahav? Rabbi Bar Chanan and Rabbi Yochanan, Yushalayim de Dahava. It is the Yushalayim of gold, meaning that it's some portrayal of Yerushalayim with its walls in a golden form. Like Rabbi Akiva made for his wife, the Gemara here is referencing to the story in the Gemara Nidarim and also Ketubot, where after getting married, Rabbi Akiva and Rachel are so poor that they're living in a barn, and while living in the barn, all the straw from the barn gets stuck in his wife's hair, and he's picking out the straw from their hair and says to her romantically, if I could afford it, I would buy you an ir shel zahav to replace all the straw that's in your hair. And eventually Rabbi Akiva is successful, does become wealthy, and does buy an ir shel zahav for his wife, which then others wanted to copy or wanted for themselves, because they saw that as the gold standard for jewelry that a husband gives to one's wife. So that's the Gemara references to it. Now, Tan Rabbanan, lo teitzei isha b'ir shel zahav. A woman may not go out with this piece of jewelry. Im yatzta chayevet chatat, divrei Rabbi Meir. The Meir says if she goes out with it, then she's chayevet a chatat, because it's considered to be a masui. It's considered to be a burden or something that she's carrying, not a tachshit. Question is, why is it not considered to be a tachshit? So the Rasha Ashir has a huge chiddush, which is that because the Chachamim, as we saw in the Mishnah, said that you can't wear it anymore on Shabbat, then it turns out to be no longer a tachshit, a piece of jewelry, because of the Chachamim's isur. And once it no longer is a piece of jewelry, then it becomes a masui, and that's why you're chayav a chatat, which is somewhat of circular logic, because the Chachamim are creating it to be a chatat, when it was only gzerat Chachamim. Plus, there's a Mishnah upcoming, which seems to indicate otherwise with regards to the sandal, and therefore they reject this view of the Rashash. On the other hand, the Rashba and the Tosfot Rosh explain that it's not considered to be a tachshit because it's so heavy. It's a big gold item, and it weighs a ton, and people don't wear it for a tachshit. They don't wear it as jewelry. They simply wear it to demonstrate their status socially or for wealth. And therefore, it was not considered to be a normal type of tachshit, and that's why Rav Meir thinks it's a masoi, and you're chayav a chatat. Chachamim omrim, which is the position that we have in our Mishnah, lo teitzei, that you shouldn't go out with it, but you're not stopped, turah. If you go out, you're turah midoraita, but it's asur midorabanan. Rabbi Eliezer omer, yotza isha b'yir shel zahav. A woman can go out, no problem with the yir shel zahav, even on Shabbat, lechatchila, without any questions. But Micah Miflegay. So what's the machloket here? Rabbi Meir Sabar Masuihu, as we mentioned, Rabbi Meir believes that it's a burden, it's something that's heavy, it's not a takshit, it's not jewelry, and that's why it's a problem. Rabbi Anan Savre Takshitu, they think that it is a piece of jewelry, but the problem, like many of the things in our Mishnah, is Dilma Shalfa Mechavyale, Ba'atyaliatuye. She'll take it off to show off to her friends, and she'll end up carrying it. Rabbi Eliezer Sabar Mandarkal, what type of woman goes out with a Yir Shel Zahav? Who wears an Yir Shel Zahav? Isha Chashuva. It's a woman of stature, a woman who's very wealthy. Isha Chashuva, lo mishalfa mechavyo. And a woman of that stature doesn't need to show off to her friends her wealth. It's a part and parcel of who she is. And therefore she doesn't need to demonstrate it by taking it off and displaying it to others. Her simply wearing it is enough. And therefore we don't have to worry about her taking it off. And then for that reason, Rabbi Eliezer believes that you can even go out the chatchila with it because only certain type of women wear it. And those women that do wear it aren't going to take it off. So now the Gemara continues and says a klila, which is a type of metal plating that the woman used to wear on her forehead that's extended from one ear to the other ear. It's similar to the tzitz of the Kohen Gadol. So a woman who wears a klila, Rabasar, says it's problematic. Shmuel, shari. And Shmuel says it is mutar. Now, the Gemara is going to qualify their statements, but Shmuel's saying that it's mutar seems strange. We just brought a machloket tanaim with regards to this matter, on the Yir Shel Zahav, and we've seen other machlokot in the tanaim as to whether we worry about a woman taking something off and showing it off or not. Why is Shmuel taking a position on this matter and being matirit in the face of the chachamim who are oser? For that reason, the Balei Tosfot say over here, Omeri, the dafka beklili shari Shmuel hocha. Shmuel is only matir with regards to the klila, and so too Rabbi Eliezer, who we saw before, was only matir with regards to an ear shel zahav. And that is because not all women went out with it. Only people of stature, only women who were very wealthy, wore these items. And so Tosfot says, "Avashar tachshitei nashim asirei afilu lisha chashuva." Any other jewelry, even though a woman who's wealthy wouldn't go around showing it off or taking it off for others to see, nevertheless, she's capturing the low plug that women can't go out with jewelry because some women take it off. So if it's jewelry that's worn both by wealthy women and ordinary women, then nobody can wear it, because even though the wealthy women don't take it off, there's a low plug. What Tosfot is suggesting over here is that the Yir Shel Zahav for Rabbi Eliezer and the Klila for Shmuel were items that were worn only by wealthy women. And now that's the question here. When you have something that's only worn by wealthy women, do we then have a gzeirah? Maybe they'll take it off and show it off? Or because women of that stature don't do that, so we're not gozer in those cases. And that way Shmuel's not really taking on all these other Tanaim that disagree, or the Rabbanon who suggests that there is a gzer the Rabbanan, because what he's suggesting is it's uniquely associated with these particular items. For Rabbi Lezer, the Yir Shel Zahav, for Shmuel, the Klila, and it seems like Shmuel would agree by the Yir Shel Zahav to the position of the Rabbanan. And that is only because these are items that are solely worn by very wealthy women, and therefore maybe they have a different status than normal jewelry that's worn by all types of women. So the Gemara says, Daniska, this type of plating or forehead ornament that went from ear to ear that's made out of a metal plate, Kulayama lo pligi dasur. Everybody agrees. That means Rav and Shmuel both agree that that's problematic and women cannot wear that. Ki plige, they only argue darukta. When it's made out of rope, as Rashi says over here, it looks like it's a twisted rope that has gold inlay and precious jewels that are put on it that the women wear across their forehead. So when it comes to something that is metallic, everybody agrees that that's significant enough that a woman would take it off and show it to her friend. And they argue about Arukta, Marsava, and the reasoning behind that is because everybody agrees by the metallic plating, if that was what she wore, she would take that off and show it to her friends. It's the question is, by the rope, what do we consider to be the ikar, the primary object here? Marsavar, Rav believes, aniska ikar, that even though it's made out of rope, the metallic inlay or the gold inlay and the stones are what make it significant, and therefore it's like metal, and it has the same din as the metal. Marsavar and Shmuel believes, arukta ikar, that the twisted rope or the strap that she wears across her forehead is what is the significant item, and therefore it's not significant enough that she's going to go and show it off to her friends. Ravashi matni lukula. Ravashi says the differentiation between Rav and Shmuel to the kula side, which is darukta dukuliyama lo plige de shari. Everybody agrees that if it's the twisted rope or it's a band that goes across her forehead, that's mutar, because women don't take that off to show off to their friends. Kiplege aniska, where they argue is only in the metallic band across the forehead. Marsava Rav believes Dilma Shafa Mechavyo, that maybe she'll take it off and show it off to her friends, and then she's going to carry it in Rishut Rabim. Marsava and Shmuel believes Mandarka Lemepak Beklilo, who goes out with this type of forehand band, is an Isha Chashuva, a woman of stature, a woman of significant social standing. Isha Chashuva Lo Shafa Mechavyo, and women of that standing don't go showing off their jewelry or that which they wear to other women, and therefore we don't have to worry about it. That goes back to what we saw in the Tosafot, that Shmuel believes that this is a unique item worn by just wealthy women, and therefore there's no reason to be gozer over here about them taking it off because of a low plug. Amarale Rav Shmuel Bar Bar Chana Rav Yosef, Feferu Shemartman Mishmei Derav Klila Shari. You told us in the name of Rav that a Klila is allowed. Rav Yosef fell ill during his lifetime and forgot much of the Torah he had learned when he was younger. And so we find many times when he's learning with Abaye and with others that they remind him of things that he said before he fell ill. And that's what seems to be happening over here. He's reminding him, he says, you told us in the name of Rav that a klila is shari. So now, because of that statement, now they bring a story that involves Rav and a klila, which is, Amrle the Rav, Ata Gavaraba Arika Lenarda Umitla. There was this really choshev individual that came to Narda. He is very tall and he is limping. Vidorash, and he was Doresh Klila Shari. He says that wearing a Klila is totally fine. Amar Mangabra Rabo Arika de Itla. Rav thinks in his mind, who's a very tall individual that limps, and that's a big Talmud Chacham, has to be Levi. So Levi was a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi. The Gemara tells us in a number of places that Rabbi held Levi in very high esteem, and it was his major Talmud. He also got himself into a little trouble because he said some things that maybe were not so appropriate, Keneged Shamayim. And he also performed a very difficult maneuver in front of Rabbi. And the Gemara tells us in Gemara in Sukkah and Tanit that both of those items caused him to fall and injure himself while he was doing that maneuver in front of Rabbi. And that's why he was limping. So now, Rav concludes from the fact that Levi has now come out to Bavel, that Shramina Nachnam Sheid Rabbi Afis, that Rabbi Afis must have passed away. Diyotiv Rabbi Chanina Bereisha, and the Rosh Hashiva is now Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama. V'lo avalei inish to Levi the Meitev Gabei. Levi no longer anybody to hang out with. V'kati locha, and that's why he came here. So Gemara says, how does he know that that's the case? Dilmanach tafshed Rabbi Chanina. Maybe Levi's Chavrusa, Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama, passed away. Rabbi Afis, k'dekai goyim, Rabbi Afis is still the Rosh Hashiva. V'lo avalei inish to Levi the Meitev Gabei. And Levi didn't have anybody to learn with. And that's why he came here. It says, Rabbi Chanina Shachiv, if Rabbi Chanina had passed away, Levi's Chavruta, Levi, Rabbi Afis, Mikav HaVikoifle. Levi to Rabbi Afis would have subjected himself to the authority of Rabbi Afis, and he wouldn't have come. And that is because, as Rashi explains over here, it's based on the Gemara in Ketubot and Kuf Gimel, where Rabbi, on his deathbed, is giving his last will and testament, and he calls in all different parties to tell them what he thinks or what should happen afterwards. In terms of the appointment of who should be the Rosh Yeshiva, he says that I want Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama to become the Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama was supposed to become Rosh Yeshiva after Rabbi's passing, but he was too much of an onav, and he knew that Rabbi Afis was older than him. And since Rabbi Afis was older than him, he didn't want to be Rosh Yeshiva before him. So therefore, he allowed Rabbi Abbas to become the Rosh Yeshiva while he waited. Now, because he was greater than him in Chochmah, he didn't feel right being inside the Beit Midrash because it would have been a challenge to Rabbi Abbas. So therefore, Rabbi Chanina remained outside the Beit Midrash. Levi kept Rabbi Chanina company outside the Beit Midrash because he was his chavruta and he had a respect for Rabbi Chanina. He stayed out with Rabbi Chanina. So that's the background to the story over here. And what they're saying now is it must be that Rabbi Abbas passed away and now Rabbi Chanina is the Rosh Yeshiva. And now Levi has nobody to learn with and Levi can't go into the Beit Midrash. That is because Rashi says over here, the age hierarchy of these individuals was that Rabbi Abbas was the oldest, then Levi, then Rabbi Chanina. So Rabbi Chanina gave up his position to Rabbi Abbas, even though he had more gadlut in Torah, because Rabbi Abbas was older than him. And therefore he deferred to him, and he became the Rosh Yeshiva. Till Rabbi Chanina then moved to the outside, waiting in a sense to become the Rosh Yeshiva, and Levi joined him outside. Now, if Rabbi Chanina had passed away and Levi lost his chavruta, he would go back into the Beit Midrash, because Rabbi Abbas was also older than Levi. And so that wouldn't have been a problem. The problem arose when Rabbi Abbas passed away, and now Rabbi Chanina goes to be the Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Chanina was both younger than Rabbi Abbas, was also younger than Levi. And so Levi didn't feel that it was right, or didn't feel appropriate to go into the Beit Midrash, or to subject himself to the ruling, the authority of Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama, and that's why he leaves to go to Bavel, and then he reunites with his old buddy Rav. Rav also learned in front of Rabbi for many years, and now Levi, who learned there, now rejoins Rav, becomes very close with Shmuel's father, and then Shmuel becomes a Talmud Chaver of Levi, and that's where we see many times in the Gemara, Levi versus Shmuel, Levi and stories about Levi and Shmuel, Levi and Rav that are involved in these situations. What the standing of Levi is in Halacha is not so clear. The Rambam gives him a lot of authority, and Paskins like Levi, whenever he argues in Rav and Shmuel, because he was older and he was a Talmud Muvak of Rabbi. So the Gemara here says that when Rav heard that this individual was tall and limping, came in, he says, gotta be Levi. And if Levi's here, that means that he lost his Chavrusa Rabbi Chanina. And the only way he lost his Chavrusa Rabbi Chanina is if Rabbi Abbas passed away, and now Rabbi Chanina is the Rosh Yeshiva. And that's why Levi came to Bavel. And the Gemara says, how do you know that? Maybe he lost his Chavrusa, and that's it. He's coming to Bavel because Rabbi Abbas is the Rosh Yeshiva. So it can't be because Levi would have not come to Bavel. He would have accepted the authority of Rabbi Abbas because Rabbi Abbas was older than him, according to Rashi. Whereas when it came to Rabbi Chanina, Levi did not feel comfortable being under his authority because he was both older than Rabbi Chanina, and he was more erudite than Rabbi Chanina. So that's why he came to Bavel, and that's why Rav concluded that. Also, the other possibility is that, Batu, the Rabbi Chanina lo sagi de la malech. It had to be that Rabbi Chanina became the Rosh Yeshiva. Because Rabbi, before he passed away, said Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama should be the Rosh Yeshiva. T'chiyava konecha nafshe de Rabbi amar Chanina Bar Chama, Rabbi Chama yati barosh, he'll be the Rosh Yeshiva. Uchti behu b'tzadikim, and it says in the Pasuk in Yob with regards to the tzadikim, v'tigzar omer v'yokom lach. That when they make a decree, or when they say something, it comes true. So if Rabbi said he's going to be the Rosh Yeshiva, he had to become the Rosh Yeshiva. So it couldn't be that he passed away and Rabbi Abbas was still the Rosh Yeshiva, because then Rabbi Chanina would never have been the Rosh Yeshiva, and the words of Rabbi would not have come true. And so because of that, that's why Rabbi believed that it must be that Rabbi Abbas passed away, Rabbi Chanina is the Rosh Yeshiva, and that's why Levi is coming to Bavel. Now, when Levi came to Bavel, Darash Levi bin Arda, Klila Shari, that the Klila is Mutar to go out with, and because of that, Nafik Esrim Ba'aba Klila Mikula Narda. Throughout the whole Narda, 24 women came out with the klila, with this crown jewelry, on Shabbat. Dorish Rabba Baravua ben Mechuza. Similarly, Rabba Baravua said the same thing in Mechuza, the klila shari, that it's muteret to wear this klila jewelry on Shabbat. Benafku tamnei sari klile mechada mevoa. And then 18 women wearing this jewelry came out of one mavoi, one section or subsection of the city. They came out from there. It seems to be that the contrast is in the terms of the wealth, that Mechuza was obviously a very wealthy city, where 18 women have it in a single section of the city, whereas throughout the whole Narda, only 24 women had a klile. So that's the intent over here. The question is, how do we reconcile everything we've seen until now? That the Rabbeinu Chananel does by saying the following. V'kaimelon k'ravashi dehu patro. When it comes to the Machloket Rav and Shmuel, the explanation of that Machloket, we're going to follow Rav Ashi, because he's a Batra, he's a later Amora, And therefore, we're going to say that when it comes to metal, that's where the machlok between Rav and Shmuel is. When it comes to a band, a cloth band, or a rope that has jewelry and metal inlaid in it, that's not going to be problematic according to everyone. And he says that since there's a machlok at Rav and Shmuel, and we know that a machlok at Rav and Shmuel, halacha k'rav b'isurei, and this is an issue of isur, so halacha is like Rav, that means that metallic ones are going to be asur. But now we have Levi and Rabba Baravua being mater klila. So in order to reconcile that, they say that they must have been speaking about these rope or cloth types of bands that were muterit even according to Rav. And in that way, you can reconcile all the opinions here. Rav paskin that it's a sore with regards to a metallic band. Rav Ashi tells us that Rav agrees by the rope or the arokta, the ritsua, or the band or the rope that it is considered to be mutar. That's what Levi and Rabba Bar Avua were paskening, that the Klila's mutar is talking about a rope band. On the other hand, the Beit Yosef says that he thinks that the Rambam and the Rif never make such a distinction between metallic or cloth bands, and therefore he believes that when we say that Levi and Rabba Bar Avua over here said it was mutaret, means all types of Klila were mutaret, and therefore he paskens in the Shulchan Aruch that any Klila is mutaret, though the Bar Alocha points out that the position of the Beit Yosef here is not so simple because it's not clear that the Rif really says what the Beit Yosef says. Plus, we know the Rabbeinu Hananel and the Rosh paskin that by metal it's a problem. And therefore, the Bar Alocha says it's kedai to be machmir when you're talking about a klila that's made of metal to not wear it on Shabbat. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav Shmuel, Kamra Shari. These types of gilded belts are mutar to be worn. Now, it seems to be that these were decorative belts, but also something that indicated your stature or status. Many times had the emblem of your social standing on it, but they were something that was worn by nobility, by kings, in order to show their standing. So, Igadamre, some say that this type of belt that we're speaking about here is darokta, which was made out of a cloth that was gilded, or it was a twisted rope with inlaid metal and jewels. And the reason that it's mutar to wear is because Amar Rav Safra mitad hava talit muzhevet. Just like a person can wear a talit that either has gold inlaid in it or is a golden type of talit, even though that's not something that people normally wear, it's something reserved for the wealthy, but because people do wear it, and it is a functional type of decorative kli, then even a person who doesn't normally wear it, if they do wear it, it's still considered to be tachshit or clothing for them, and therefore it's mutar for them to wear it. And similarly over here, the gilded belt, even though that's something worn by people of higher social standing, someone else wears it, it's not going to be problematic. Ikadame daniska. Some say that the belt is made out of metal. Vamarav safra midav avnet shel melachim. And that'd be similar to the belt of kings, which again was something that of significant, that had their emblems on it. And because of that, it was worn by those that were wealthy and kings, and if a regular layperson wears it, it will not be considered to be a masui because it is a piece of clothing for some individuals of higher standing, but because of that, it's okay for you to wear it as well. Now that's the explanation of Rashi over here, which is that kol b'nei Yisrael b'nei melachim heim, which is a position that's taken in the Mishnah later on in Kuf Yud Aleph. Other Rishonim don't love that explanation because that's only one day up in the Mishnah later on. And they suggest that the reason it's true over here is because people don't normally take it off and display it to other people. It's the type of item that is used to hold up your clothing. And since it's holding up your clothing, people don't take it off to show it to other people because then all your clothing would drop down. So we're one of those two reasons. We're not gozer, either in the case where it's made out of some sort of decorative ritsua, or it's made out of metal, people don't take it off because if then all their clothes would drop down and it wouldn't be appropriate to do that. It'd be like getting undressed in the middle of the shuk. So people aren't going to take it off to show to others. And because everybody has the status of being Menei Melachim, therefore it's ra'oi, this type of clothing for them, and therefore it's considered to be a takshit or normal clothing for them, not something that's unusual. What's interesting over here is that it's actually a machlok bishonim as to whether we worry about men in general taking off items to show up. Is that just a practice or a nature of women to show off their jewelry and their clothing, and then we worry about it? But with men, we don't worry about that type of issue. Or does it also apply by men? So many, like the Ramban, bring our Gemara as a proof that we do worry about by men, because over here we're talking about a kamra, which is a belt that's worn by men, and we see by the answers given in the Gemara that we do possibly worry about it being taken off had it not been for the fact that people don't take it off because their clothes are going to drop down. But had it not been for that factor, we would have assumed that they can take it off, or they would take it off, and men are just as likely to show off what they're wearing that as women are. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam believed that it's only something done by women, and by men we do not have that chashash. And in defense of the Rabbeinu Tam, the Ran brings over here that the reason he believes that this case is different, or how he learns that from this case, is the fact that the Gemara doesn't deal with it from the side of a tachshit, of it being a decorative item, a piece of jewelry, rather from a side of it being clothing. And the problem here is that this is a piece of clothing that's only worn by a certain very wealthy or high-standing individuals. And now we want to know, if another person or a lay person wears it, what's the status of it for that person? And the Gemara's answer is that it's a piece of clothing for them, just like it's a piece of clothing for the person of high stature that wears it. But it's a question of malbush versus masui, being a burden versus clothing, not a question of jewelry. Because had it been jewelry, then it wouldn't have been an issue at all, because men don't take off jewelry to show off to others. And for that reason, the Rabbeinu Tam sees this as a proof to his position, because the Gemara doesn't address it from the standpoint of Tachshit, only from the standpoint of Malbush. Although the Balei Tosfot over here seem to undermine that somewhat when they say that even for women, it's considered to be normal to wear this and not take it off because their clothing would drop down, implying that the belts that we're speaking about here and the kamar that we're speaking about here are women's wear or not men's wear. Now the Gemara continues and says, Amale Ravina the Ravashi, Kamra Ilui Hemyano Mai. If you have this kamra sitting on top of a belt, what's the din? Amale Tre Hemyane Kamart? You're talking about two belts? So now the Gemara doesn't say what that means. He asks it in a rhetorical manner, but we don't know what that means. So Rashi brings from each of his Rebbeim a different explanation. According to Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yehuda, he says that that means that it's definitely a masui, and it's a sur, because it's two belts. And what's the point of wearing two belts? The second belt is definitely a masui. The other possibility he brings from Rabbeinu Alevi, where he says that it's mutar, meaning that it's another piece of clothing, so why can't you wear it? Rashi says, Rishon Nirali, says that I think that the first explanation is correct, that it means that it's asur here, because it's extraneous. And he brings a proof from the Gemara later on in the Masechta. When you have a fire in a house, what clothing you're allowed to wear out to salvage from the fire and not be in violation of the Takanat Chachamim to take things out when there is a fire. So it has to be clothing that you would normally wear. Over there, Rashi points out that it doesn't offer you the option to put on a second belt. So that shows you that the second belt is problematic. The Bai Tosafot say that even though they think Rashi's right about the fact that it means the Isur over here, he does say that the Gemara later on does have a second belt that's mentioned in the number of clothing or items or articles of clothing that you're allowed to take out from the fire. So Tosafot then makes a distinction and says that if it's a belt on top of a belt, that's what we're speaking over here, that's problematic because that's completely unnecessary. That's just a duplication and that's a masui. On the other hand, if you have a belt on one piece of clothing, they have a second piece of clothing that has another belt on top of it, that's fine. And that's what the Gemara later on is speaking about in Kitvei HaKodesh, that they can salvage two belts, one belt that goes on the tunic, for instance, and another belt goes around the coat or the jacket that you're wearing. So that's fine, because each one has a purpose for the piece of clothing that's attached to, and in that way you make such a distinction. And Tosfot also points out that this is differentiated or distinct from people wearing layers of clothing to stay warm. If it's very cold outside and you wear layers and layers of clothing, that is something that is okay and not considered to be extraneous, just wearing duplicate clothing, because there it has purpose and it gives you the benefit of keeping you warm. Over here, when you have a belt on top of a belt, there's no purpose to it. It doesn't serve any utility. There's no other additional benefit by having the second belt. And for that reason, it's considered to be a masui. I'm Rav Ashi. Hi, risuka. This, either translated as a corset or a half jacket. Iitle mafrechaito shari ilo asir. If it has, according to Rashi over here, pindatza, which are like pendants, or as Rashi describes over here, short strings that they use to tie it very tight around the individual, then it's mutar, because since it's so tightly pulled around the individual, there's no way that the individual is going to take it off or carry it in Rishut Rabim, because both the effort to put it together and the tight fit that it has, then people don't take that off, they leave it on. On the other hand, if it's missing those and it's worn loosely, and it's like a half jacket, then it's easy to remove or easy to take it off. And then we do worry about the individual carrying it in the Rishut HaRabim, because the snaps or whatever's holding it together might break apart or loosen up, and then it would fall off, or you'd want to take it off. Because when it's very tight, then we don't worry about that because the pressure's on it already and it's holding tight. Nothing's going to change. It's in place. Whereas when it's loose, there's a possibility that it will loosen and fall off, and then you can end up carrying it, and that would be problematic in Rishut Rabbim. That's Rashi's view. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Hanan over here says that the difference between having these stringy items on it is whether it's considered to be a takshit or a masa. They say it's a leather jacket that has tassels on it. Then it's considered to be a takshito, perish chagur shel or, some sort of leather belt or leather item that you wore. If it has these mafrachaita, which are shari, because takshitu, then it's considered to be a decorative item. V'i lo, asur, perush. And the explanation is, if it has these mafrachaita, which are chetichot yotzot, v'otfot mimenu. You have these little tassels that hang off of it. Let me know the smolo. On the right and left, that's considered to be a takshit. But if not, then it's asur to go out with it, the Shabbat, ki ainu kli, because it's not a kli, it's not functional in any way, it's not really a malbush, and since it doesn't have that decorative quality to it, it becomes a masui. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots towards the bottom of Nuntet Amud Bet.